Welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. Now your hosts.
Hello and welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. I'm John Alois, joined by Sean Degenhart.
Check one, check two.
And John Redlink Schaefer.
What do I have to do? Check three and check four?
There you go.
Hey, I've done this before.
You catch on real quick.
Yeah. What about five or six? Who's doing that?
We're glad you're with us in spirit. You can join us on social media, follow us, contact us there, or send us an email at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. If you have a Disney
get
review.
Get another actor.
It's our first seance episode.
If you have a Disney review, send us a voice recorded message at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. And we may play it on the show. Wherever you're listening to us, please subscribe. You'll never miss an episode. It is free. Not many things are free, but that one is, you know, our show is still free for the time being. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts,
No
announcement. Please rate and review. It helps more people find the show.
Are you setting up a Patreon without telling
us? Alois specific content.
Right.
All straight to his pocket.
Oh, man.
It's time for our Disney Views.
Recently, I was disappointed to receive an email from the Disney Movie Club, and I'm going to read part of it. After serving over 10 million valued club members, we have made the difficult decision to close the Disney Movie Club. We will miss the opportunity to be part of the lives of so many Disney fans, including you, but we will be forever grateful for the time you've chosen to spend with us. But we're not done yet in the months to come. We'll be piling on the perks to celebrate you, our loyal member. Look for amazing offers to help you finish building your collection with movies you love for memories that are yours to cherish forever.
That means they have to liquidate their assets and clean out the storage units. And
maybe explain for myself and the listeners what this club is.
I think we've been part of it for maybe 20, 25 years. Essentially, it was like, do you remember when you would order back in the day tapes or records and you'd be part of a music club? It's the same
Columbia
type.
Columbia House, yes.
Yeah, Columbia.
You once still that, owe for that one on record.
That and my Blockbuster card. Yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
Well, the first, you know, 10 or so, I think are on the lower end as far as pricing goes.
And then, quality of a movie? No.
And then as you collect, you actually save the more you buy if you buy in bulk. And, you know, every holiday season we were purchasing gifts, and a lot of those would include movies. And I still collect movies. So it's kind of strange to me, but, you know, it feels like they've been heading in this direction for a little while.
Does this have to do with the recent news of Sony, the Sony deal of them going to be producing?
Let's talk about that.
Heaven forbid I have insight and go off of John's notes. Let's get back in order.
Well, let me just say this. So I don't know. We'll talk about Sony in one second. But one of the benefits of the Disney Movie Club was they had films that were exclusive to the club. So many Walt-era live-action films, many TV movies for Wonderful World of Color, Wonderful World of Disney throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You could only purchase those at the club. So I don't know what the future of that means. But like you said, shortly after the announcement, we found out Disney has made a deal with Sony Entertainment to distribute all physical media, including DVDs and Blu-rays. And we don't know yet how this is going to shake out. I assume they'll have access to Disney's back catalog. Hopefully they can distribute those films. This would be amazing if that is the case. I'm a collector. Disney likes to put things in the vault. Maybe some of that's going to change. We'll see.
It was just such a weird announcement. You would think, I mean, just going with Sony as their distributor, I mean, does Sony have that bigger of a catalog that they've got the equipment to handle that, where it's, you know, it's not a huge cost to them? Or it was just, it was odd.
Yeah, I don't know. Or if there's some sort of partnership maybe happening that's going to expand.
Is Disney deciding what they want released, or are they giving Sony, you know, okay, here's our catalog, you do what you want with it.
I can't imagine that.
Right, that doesn't make any sense.
You know, the more you release, I guess the value maybe comes down a little bit. One of the reasons why back in the day Disney videotapes and DVDs were always more expensive was because they would throw them in the vault and they would make them, you would be difficult to pick those up. And every 7 years they would re-release, maybe with some new extra content. If Sony releases the whole catalog, I don't know.
I'm just sitting here. Is it just logistics?
Right.
And let someone else do it.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Or have the honor of doing it for us, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
The world has fallen in love with streaming. We know that. But many of these companies have pulled their content. Max, Disney Plus. I think physical media is important. I think the Disney Blu-rays and DVDs are going to become collector's items, especially if the new re-released content doesn't have the bonus features that those other
That's one thing
have.
I've noticed even with Disney Plus, like on WALL-E, the WALL-E Blu-ray has a great sound editing audio, you know, featurette that is not included on Disney Plus. So it would be nice to have a place to go for those.
Up until maybe the last five Pixar films, they blew everyone else out of the water with their special features. Those have dwindled a little bit recently. But WALL-E, all those original, the first 10 years of Pixar had amazing content as their bonus features. And by the way, Disney Home Entertainment has been around since 1978.
All right. Well, we are very excited. We've been waiting for this interview for a while. We are thrilled to have with us who I might call today's Buddy Baker of the Disney Studios. Buddy was, of course, a staff writer and wrote, you know, scores for many Disney films back in the day. We have with us Academy and Tony and Grammy Award-winning composer, orchestrator, arranger, conductor, emptier of trash cans. What don't you do? Dave Metzger. Dave, welcome to the Hyperion Hub.
Great. Thank you so much, Sean, for having me. And what an honor to be even mentioned in the same breath as Buddy Baker. I mean, he was one of my idols, and I learned so much just from listening and analyzing his work. So that means a tremendous amount to me. Thank you for that.
So before we get to what we want to talk about quite a bit is Once Upon a Studio, which we love and has been one of our favorite shorts. And we've upped the viewing count, I think, on Disney Plus between the three of us a lot. But tell us about your beginnings, your origin story musically.
Oh, wow. Well, I grew up, and cut me off too if this gets too long. I grew up in a non-musical family, was so fortunate to... actually, my dad was tone deaf and could only recognize the Star Spangled Banner by the words. I'm not kidding. That's really true, and that's kind of wild. But had no musical training when I was super young. Got very lucky to be put in randomly a choir class in seventh grade. I wanted to be in a woodshop class, and it was full, so they just sort of jammed me in this choir class that happened to have an amazing teacher who was also a composer, and I noticed that she was writing a lot of the music we were singing, so that I was inspired by that, and by the first Christmas vacation, I had written an arrangement of Barbara Ann, a very simple four-part, just off my head, because I couldn't play piano or anything, and brought it into her to the shore, and she saw something there and nurtured me, and so I started writing music. Kind of that became my passion, and took my first year of college music theory in ninth grade, and started writing big band music and band music in ninth grade, and was studying Stravinsky and Ravel and Debussy and all these scores starting in ninth grade and 10th grade, and saw the first Star Wars movie, the very first one, when I was 16 years old, and became at that point enamored with film music. And from age 16, I knew I wanted to have a career in film music. I didn't know any idea. I grew up in Oregon, in a small town in Oregon, didn't have any idea what that really even meant, but went to California, for Southern California, for college undergrad, because I figured LA was where all films are made, and just kind of climbed the ladder and moved back to Oregon when I was 30 after having not really accomplished too much. But my first son was born. So that was actually a wonderful accomplishment, I suppose, and that I'm very thankful for. When I moved, had made the connection to write for The Tonight Show when Jay Leno had taken over, and right literally 2 weeks before moving back to Oregon. And so for the first 5 years living up here in the early 90s, I wrote about 250 pieces for The Tonight Show, all from Oregon, and then made the connection. Finally, my first film work was actually on the classic movie Speed 2, not Speed 1, Speed 2.
That dramatic pause got me, yes.
Yeah. The wonderful thing about that is I was connected with the composer on that was a guy named Mark Mancina, who had been, is a well-respected film composer, and he and I hit it off, and the next thing right after that film was finished, he asked me if I, he had been hired by Disney to be the music producer of the music for the Broadway version of The Lion King. And the orchestrator just dropped out, and he asked if I'd be interested in orchestrating that show. And I said, sure. And that show is still running today, 27 years later, as the top grossing Broadway show right now, even has taken back over Hamilton and has been in running in London for 25 years and has, I think, 10 or 12 other companies around the world still going. So So that then most importantly solidified my relationship with Mark, who then after that hired, I was nominated for Tony Award, didn't win for best orchestrations, but that was meaningless. It was just getting the chance to do that show was a miracle and could never have expected that. Then immediately after that, Mark and I jumped into Tarzan, which was the Disney animated version of Tarzan with Phil Collins. So I orchestrated every note of that and arranged and orchestrated all the songs with Phil. And one thing led to another, and I'm probably 85 films or so later, and here we are today. Finally getting my opportunity to be the composer of note. I'd done a lot of ghostwriting or additional composition throughout the decades, and finally had a chance on Once Upon a Studio and Wish to be the composer of note at long last, and very don't have any idea how it happened, and I'm very thankful for it. But literal dream come true for me.
So, what was it like growing up with Disney? Was Disney a part of your growing up years?
Yep, very much so. My parents, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, I suppose. So my parents actually did take me to Disney films. And I remember really my first one and the one that I loved the most of all was The Jungle Book, the original animated version. And I just remember singing, the songs from that pretty much on loop at 7 years old. I think I would have been 7 or 8 probably. So then, as I got into my teens, I kind of dropped out of the Disney thing because of a lot of teens tend to. But then I came back when I have two sons, and when they were young kids, then we became very much Disney, exposed them to Disney. So, and that would have been in the Renaissance, you know, like in the the early 90s, you know, through the 90s. And so I had to have seen Beauty and the Beast on DVD, I'm sorry, on VHS, mm-hmm. at least 400 or 500 times probably, because I would watch it with them, and it was really as much for me as for them, I suppose. And of course Aladdin, and you know, all the films from that era, which were the Menken films for the most part, and picked up a lot from from Alan and also Danny Troob, his orchestrator, learned a lot from him, and I like to think you can sort of hear some homages to Danny in some of my work here and there, and I've had the fortunate to work on a few movies with Alan Menken over these last handful of years as well. Again, long answer, sorry, but Disney has definitely been a big part of my life, and then certainly once I started working for them, they've been a big part, and I love working for the studio.
As far as animation, the animation world goes, as somebody who produces music, was it obvious that Disney was producing the best animation music? You had kids that were at the right age, you were seeing Disney movies, but you were also seeing probably other movies as well. Did you know Disney was at their best at that point?
Oh, for sure. I can't even sort of think of any other animated films in that era that I would have even watched. I know there obviously were some, but for very much I knew, and especially on the music side, you know, I mean, that was just a brilliant era, you know, and I'm so fortunate to, I think I can honestly say that I was the very tail end part of it. I think that Tarzan might be considered to be maybe at the very tail end of that. I don't know if you guys feel differently. You know, you probably wouldn't include it, but I sort of, at least I think I was at least a little bit of the fortunate to be at the tail end of that. But for sure, you know, Disney, without a question, in that era in the 90s, there was no other game in my book. And that's how I feel about it.
Can you, for our listeners, maybe explain the difference, who may not know, okay, what does an arranger do versus an orchestrator versus a composer? You know, kind of delineate some of those different responsibilities for us.
Yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to do that, because it's so hard to know if you're not sort of in the business or in the know of what they are. And there are different interpretations too, right? So the way I look at it, my interpretation is, and I'll start with the composer, especially in songs I'm going to talk about right now, the composer is the person or team, usually anymore, that will come up with the melody and the chord changes and the lyrics and the words. So they kind of come up with the basic germ of the idea. And what you get from different composers, I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of different composers or songwriters, is going to vary a lot. Some are pretty detailed in their harmonic structure, so the chords are pretty detailed, and some are going to be less so. You might even just get kind of like a held, two bars of a held C major chord, and then you move to two bars of an F major chord or whatever. So there's a wide range there in what you get. Then the next step on the chain is the arranger. And the arranger is going to put in, write counter melodies, so like if you listen to kind of like Frozen songs, like I can think one of the ones that jumps in my mind that I worked on was For the First Time in Forever. So you have the melody line going on, what's being sung, but then if you're listening, you hear I put in French horn counter melodies that kind of will answer the melody, or fill the holes of the sung melody. So that's one of the functions of an arranger. An arranger also might take the chord changes and make them more sophisticated. So like not just have the sort of original basic chords from the songwriter, the arranger will change up, maybe go in different places harmonically than were originally in the song. The other thing that arrangers will do will be sometimes play with the style of the song. Another example, going back to For the First Time in Forever, when that song, I didn't know it, but Bobby and Kristen had, I actually only had a day and a half to do that arrangement and orchestration because of other films I was working on at the time. So I spun it in a direction of, I knew I could go to two different directions. One was to go with more of a pop version, like with the rhythm section, or else to go more kind of classic Disney, like what a school Disney kind of thing would have been. I had about 10 minutes I knew to make that decision. I went the classic Disney orchestra way. But in talking with Bobby and Kristen a year later, I realized they told me that they originally had written it with a Billy Joel kind of feel in mind. So they originally actually were envisioning it as a pop song, but we didn't have time to talk about it because I just had to move so fast. So, but they were very happy with the way I went, and it kind of surprised them. But anyway, that would be another example of what an arranger might contribute, would be a stylistic decision on it. Normally I would have run it by the I did run it by the composers because I played it for them when I had it done, and they were happy with it. But anyway, and then to get to the next level then would be the orchestrator. And the orchestrator is going to take really be, in my mind, is more concerned with the colors of the song or the score cue, whatever. So and there's different levels for sure. I orchestrate my own arrangements. So when I'm doing my arrangement, I'm mocking up everything in a sequencer with samples that sound like what the real orchestra is going to be like. And because I'm pretty well trained, I do my mock-ups that are very exacting as to what the orchestration is going to be. There's, when I'm done with my sequence, there's no question on what instruments are going to play what, and such. But some orchestrators are given much less direction, and so it's up to them to kind of decide the colors and what instruments are going to play what melody lines, or counter melody lines. So in my book, if an orchestrator is coming up with With counter melodies and chord changes that are different than what they were given, they've kind of crossed over into being an arranger. They might not be credited as such, but they really are kind of arranging at that point. I'm hoping that's kind of understandable and not too mm-hmm. technical or too goofy.
No, that for someone who's not anywhere related to the business, that's incredibly helpful. And what I kind of want to piggyback off of this, you say the technical. You probably, thinking about the timing and the duration of your career, you've seen a technological change of how you do all of this. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking old days, sitting at a piano, got my paper out, got my pencil, and now you were talking about all these pieces of equipment I can't even wrap my head around that's probably at your disposal. Do you find one part of your career easier in terms of the technology? What does the layman want to know from you about how technology really does impact what you do on a daily basis?
Yeah, well, John, you nailed it completely. I've been around long enough to where I started out doing everything by pencil and paper. And again, since I'm not a pianist, I always went just straight from my head to the paper because it would slow me down to try to figure it out on an instrument because I just wasn't, you know, able to do it. And so, so I started out there, but I was really early to jump into the technology side of thing too. So I always feel very fortunate that I'm old as I am and as young as I am, right? Because I'm old enough to where I had to learn to do everything by hand in the old school way. But I'm young enough to where technology was just hitting at the very in my early 20s. So I bought my first computer in 1983. It was an Atari ST, you know, and with no hard drive, you know, and so and it had one megabyte of memory. Was
wow!
And that was rocking. That was a lot. You know? And so. But I started out there and was always interested in technology. So I bought, there was very early iterations of sequencing technology, which was like a tape recorder, you know, where you can play in all of the data, but it was very rudimentary at that point. And notation, I got into Finale when it was version 1.1. I wasn't 1.0, but it was like almost at the beginning. I think that was about 85 or 86. So I started doing the stuff, or the technology side was always appealing to me as well. But since I had trained and studied and written, I'd written so many scores by that time by hand that was exactly how I thought. And I was also a music copyist for a little while too, right? So it was all by hand with ink, you know, pens that you filled the ink, you know, into and stuff like that. And so I had to learn about page layouts for the musicians because, you know, there's all these other little technical things that to make it easy for the recording musician so that they don't have to stop playing to turn their page. You have to figure out where rests are for them, right? So I had all of these, this knowledge as well, pre-technology, that helps a lot when you're dealing with the technology. But so then, you know, in the early 90s, when I was doing all the Tonight Show stuff, that was all in Finale. So I did all the work in Finale and printed it up on a dot matrix printer and faxed it down to Burbank, you know, because I was living in Oregon. And but then, because it was before the internet, but I still did all my big orchestral scores by hand because it was still more efficient to do it that way. Then I didn't really switch over to doing my movie scores in notation software until probably 2006, So up to that point, all the Tarzan scores are back here and they're all by hand, you know, they're all written by hand. Wow. And I would say it was easier probably when I was younger and doing it by hand, but the reality of the world in film industry today is you have to do these mock-ups. You have to present to the director what it's going to sound like with samples before you get to go into the studio, because it's so expensive, you know, to have 80, 90, 100 musicians there renting, you know, Fox or Abbey Road or whatever, you know, with the engineers and all those stuff. So, and because of the technology exists, you can do these mock-ups now that are very accurate of what it's going to sound like when you get the real musicians on there. So it's kind of easier but harder now, I'd say, because doing the mock-up, I'm fortunate enough that I had the experience that I could write it faster doing it by hand, but it's just not the reality. The reality is you just have to do the mock-ups now, and I don't mind it. It's kind of fun and challenging in its own way, but But I kind of miss the old days a little bit.
I started in Finale with Finale 3.2. I remember buying that box, and the books were, you know, about 3 inches thick.
Giant.
And we, the computer lab we had at college, had those little Apple computers with about the 6-inch screens.
Yeah, like so the FEs or whatever.
So there's no way you could do a full score, you know, with that, because you'd be sliding the mouse over for every measure and every staff. So let's talk about Once Upon a Studio. This special, as I said earlier, we loved it. We probably watched it a dozen times in the first couple days just to catch stuff that we had missed, you know, the first 5 or 6 times that we had watched it. It was exactly, we just interviewed Dan and Trent and Brad, and we told them it was everything we wanted that short to be. And so you had a huge part of that. Writing the score for it and orchestrating it. So let's talk about that. When did they bring you on to the project?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I kind of felt like Wish and Once Upon a Studio were a twofer for me, because I was started to be talked about both of them at the very same time. And so, and since they're both in the Regis, or whatever, the purview of Disney Animation, it was sort of the same people I was talking to as far as being involved. But so that was, I want to say my first meeting with Brad and Trent and Dan and Yvette would have been, maybe September, a year ago September. So September of 2022. Mm-hmm. And it was still kind of in process at that point. You know, they were still editing and trying to make decisions on, you know, voices and who they could do. And what I had to do the first thing, now it's all, I'm sorry, it's been a year that I've been finished on Once Upon a Studio. I finished it a year ago, so I'm trying to remember, like, what was it? You know, but, and now I remember the very first thing I had to do was the arrangement of When You Wish Upon a Star that's at the end of the film. And because they needed to have that to be able to start recording all the characters, the voice actors for that. So that was the first thing I needed to do. And I want to say I had to be done with that by early October. And so then there was the process of recording those voice actors and the singing. And so then I had a little bit of a break and switched over to Wish. And then the film was ready for me, Once Upon a Studio was ready for me to start working on the score at the very end of December. And so it's was sad but a little fortuitous that we were supposed to have my whole family with us at Christmas week, you know, in December. And but then my younger son who lives in New York City got caught up in all the weather, so he couldn't get out for like 5 days, so because of delays, so he didn't end up coming. And then my mother-in-law and sister-in-law were going to come and visit, but my wife got a horrible flu, and so we didn't want them to come because my mother-in-law is 88, and my wife was so sick, she was in bed literally for like a week. And so then I figured, well, I just will be working, you know, my vacation was kind of blown. So I started composing the score for Once Upon a Studio. Then it would have been probably December 26, I suppose, of 2022. And I blocked it all out in that first week. But it was very complicated, as you can imagine, because there's so many tempo changes and it goes so many places that it took a good solid week for me to block out my my tempo map and my thematic ideas and where it was going to go.
And that's one thing I noticed. You know, they said there's 543 characters, I believe, and there's probably that many musical quotes in that score. I mean, what a joy to be able to revisit some of those classic scores and pull little motifs and even orchestration styles, you know, the opening is very contemporary and bright, and that whole sequence of walking out of the studio with Bernie. And then as soon as Mickey pops out, you know, I mean, it's 1930s, 1940s orchestration styles and all of those things. I mean, what a joy that had to have been to work on.
Well, I appreciate that so much. That means a lot to me. And I really did study. One of the things I've been so fortunate about for having worked with Disney for so long is over the decades, I've had reason to get copies of those original scores for certain things. One of the things I'm working on right now is the live action remake of Snow White that I've been working on for 4 years already, and it still has a year and a half to go. But so like because of that, I was able to get the original Snow White scores to like study, and I was able to get Pinocchio scores for some other reason. And so, and if I had any requests like Peter Pan, I was able to get, like, ask, hey, can you just send me the Peter Pan scores? And so, and I'm a scoreaholic, you know, like I love studying those things. And so even if I wasn't working on Once Upon a Studio, I would have died for the opportunity to do that. So I look for what are the voicing techniques from 1939, you know, and 1952, you know, and so I could really, and I think that's probably why it was maybe a little of interest to be the composer on this, because they knew I'd probably do that and go through and really be authentic to the eras and to the and do my best to honor the, you know, original films and such. And so that I'm so glad, Sean, that you noticed that and mentioned that, because I really enjoyed it. It was an absolute thrill to be able to dig into that, those were right up my alley, you know, that kind of stuff. So
I have a process question for you, and I am dominating this conversation.
Go ahead.
So when you're working with like Cliff Edwards vocals with Jiminy mm-hmm. Cricket, did those mm-hmm. stems exist? Did you overlay your orchestration over what was there, or just supplement with it, or were those merged together? You know, all those kind of
That's a wonderful observation. Yep, wonderful observation. And what I ended up doing, that was kind of with Dan and Trent. That was something that was up in the air for the first bit of if we're going to try to use. I think it was both of them. They're both, you know, they're even more Disney, you know, maniac than I am, you know, right? But, you know, but so in a good way. But they were very much wanting to use the original Jiminy Cricket line, but it doesn't exist being isolated out anywhere. So when we decided, finally committed to where we were going to do that, well, that meant a couple of things. That meant for me, that was the key I had to be in for that range, because I had to take into account all of the singers' ranges, right? When I chose a key, for one, that's an arranging question, as we discussed earlier, you know, a thing the arranger has to think about. But so I had to think of the original, my key was set then for that segment. And then I also, tempo was very much set, because I couldn't alter, I had to nail exactly the tempo for that section, because it had to match up to his phrasing. And then I also then knew that the technique was going to be done by the music department. Andrew Page, I think, was the guy, or Earl Ghaffari, I can't remember, but they've been at the animation music department forever. But they had to then do the best thing as technology allows anymore to isolate his vocals and to try to eliminate all of the backgrounds, but you can't get it completely clean. You know, you can get it pretty close, but you can't. So then I knew at that point I had to go back to the original orchestration and for those couple of bars, do exactly what was there originally, so that there wouldn't be any funkiness going on. And I think it actually worked pretty well. Mm-hmm. But
it's kind of like the Natalie Cole, you know, singing with her dad. The Natalie Cole singing with her dad. That
exactly.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly right, except for 20, 30 years later, right. You know, so technology is a little better now than it was then, but perfect example of a similar usage. But yeah, so that was a technical challenge there for sure.
And, was there ever any request to not use Jiminy Cricket at that moment because it would have been so much easier, or was that always going to be part of the plan?
With Dan and Trent, that was always okay. That was really... at least as long as I had been on the project. And I think it was a great call. You know, I think
absolutely
really worked.
Join us next week for the second part of our conversation with Dave Metzger. We'll talk more about Once Upon a Studio. How amazing and thrilling it's been for us to talk to the creators of this wonderful short. But not only that, just talking to these creators, they're actually working today and producing for the Disney Studio. Part 2 next week. I want to remind you about the Disney Fest in Peoria, Illinois, at the Peoria Riverfront Museum. It's a weekend filled with Disney fun. March 22nd through the 24th. Listen to all we've got going on that weekend. We'll have trivia night. The movie Lady and the Tramp will be presented. 101 Dalmatians, Silly Symphonies, Shorts, Frank and Ollie documentary, a book signing, Disney-themed laser light shows, Draw It with Joe, the art guy, and special guests, author J.B. Kaufman and director-producer Ted Thomas. Disney Fest 2024 is sponsored by Janine and Steve Spain and Visionary Society, March 22nd through the 24th. Till then, please make sure you follow us. Make sure you like and subscribe. Make sure you rate and review and email us with any show ideas or any reviews you may have. podcast@thehyperionhub.com. Till next week, have a great one, everyone.
We're glad you could join us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email or send us a recorded audio message at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. Find us on social media. The Hyperion Hub is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company or its subsidiaries. We'll meet you next time at the Hyperion Hub.